The 20th story, The Shepherd King. How great an event in the history of mankind is the birth of a child. None can tell what its future is to be. Do you suppose that the mother of Napoleon, when she held her little dark-skinned Italian baby in her arms, ever thought he would one day be the most famous man of his age, the Emperor of the French? Of course not. No more did Jesse, the good old farmer of Bethlehem, ever dream that the ruddy, red-cheeked lad who sang songs to himself while he tended his father's sheep would one day be the great King David, ruler over Israel. The most historic spot in all the world is the little town of Bethlehem. It is different, of course, today from what it was in David's time. Once it was called Ephratah, which means the fruitful, and even after centuries of oppression under the rule of the Muslim, its vine-clad hills and olive orchards still give it some right to the name. In the center of the little town is an open square, and on the farther end of it is a great church which covers the spot where, nearly 2,000 years ago, a greater king than David was born. Many of the striking things in the history of Israel are connected with Bethlehem. We first hear of the little town in connection with the great grief of Jacob for the death of his beloved Rachel. Indeed, if you will leave the village and go for a little way down the old Jerusalem road, you will come to a white-domed little mosque which marks her grave. From across the distant blue mountains of Moab came the beautiful Ruth to Bethlehem to work in the fields of her kinsman Boaz, afterward her husband. David was Ruth's great-grandson, and it was his name which first brought fame to Bethlehem. It was because of David's love for Bethlehem and his attachment to the home of his childhood that he had so strong a hold upon the hearts of the men of Judah. The first few years after David became king of all Israel, there was a great deal of fighting. He conquered the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites. David's army was everywhere successful. Jerusalem became a powerful capital, and David a mighty king. One of the first things he did, you know, was to bring the Ark of the Lord to Jerusalem, and in the peaceful years which followed the close of the great wars, he began to think about building a temple where it should be kept. Why, he asked himself, should I live in a cedar-roofed and cedar-lined palace while the Ark of the Lord has but a tent? Shall my house then be a greater place than the house of the Lord? Would not a splendid temple with a high altar on which should rest the Ark of God call forth more reverence and a deeper devotion among my people? David thought so much about the building of a temple that he called in Nathan the prophet and asked his advice. At first Nathan favored the plan, but in the night the voice of God spoke to him, and in the morning he revealed to David what the Lord had said. The ark had shared the wandering of Israel since the day of Moses. The Lord had never asked for it a more gorgeous temple. The simple tent which enclosed it was a sign of their simple faith. But because it had been in David's heart to do this thing, the Lord, speaking through Nathan, made a promise to David that the throne of Israel should never depart from his house, that the kingdom should not be taken away from his family as it had been from Saul and his children. The reign of David was one of glory for many years, but after the wrong he did to Uriah, his honest, faithful soldier, there began a period of decline. The kingdom lost none of its fruitful lands, it is true, but the people became disunited and restless. Never afterward was there unity among them. The peace, the hearty boldness in all its enterprises, the good fortune, all were gone. The men of Israel were fearlessly honest. Any man of them might have as many wives as he chose, but he could not break the seventh commandment and still be held in honor, no, not even the king. David reaped the consequences of his misdeeds. They came back to him in the conduct of his children. Amnon, the oldest, was guilty of a worse crime than his father's. Absalom and Adonijah repaid his love and kindness with treachery and ingratitude, and not long afterward the country was visited by a terrible famine. For 3 years there was scarcely any rain. The crops were so poor that the people starved. David called the priest to him and said, I pray thee, ask of God the cause of our misfortunes. When the priest returned, he told David that the famine had been sent them because of the evil doing of Saul, the former king, toward the tribe that dwelt at Gibeon in Canaan. They had been promised by Joshua that no harm should come to them, but Saul had not honored the promise. He had fallen upon them in battle and had slain their sons. David made them offers of gold and silver, but they would not be satisfied. They wanted revenge. They demanded that 7 of Saul's grandsons should be given them to be hanged. David was helpless. He had no choice but to consent. On account of his love for and his oath to Jonathan, he saw that his son was spared. But when it came time for the barley harvest, about the beginning of April, the 7 grandsons of Saul were hanged, and their bodies allowed to hang till the rain should fall again. But Rizpah, the mother of 2 of the lads, came to the high rock to watch over the bodies of her dead sons. She thought not of anything but her love for her slaughtered boys and their kinsmen. Her conduct was a revelation of the mighty love of a mother, a story which should never be forgotten in the whole history of humanity. During all those dreary months, she sat, day after day and night after night, by the crosses on which hung the bodies of her boys. The sun and the wind must do as it will, she thought, but while I watch, the vultures and the wild beasts shall not touch them. When the rain fell, she took them away and buried them with Jonathan and Saul in the family tomb at Zelah. David's long reign came to an end at last. He was more than 70 years old, and although it was the ancient law that no one should be buried within the city walls, the law was set aside in the case of the king. The city which he had captured and had done so much to build up should hold his tomb. For many and many a year, those who were proud of their race pointed out with pride the place where lay the bones of their great king. In the Pentecostal sermon, St. Peter says, "His sepulcher is with us to this day." Now, no man knows the spot, but somewhere among the hills, and under the ruins of that ancient city lie the bones of the Shepherd King, the man after God's own heart, awaiting the resurrection.